Okay, so we are in the week of Thanksgiving, obviously. So I thought I would talk about inflation today. This does, in name, I suspect, have a relation to economic inflation. Inflationary theory came up right around 1980, became very popular in the early 80s. I think Alan Guth first derived it in late 1979. At the time, inflation in the economy was much, much worse than it is now. People spent all the run-up to the election whining about how bad inflation was. We flipped through considerably worse. It does suck. It's not something that was good for the economy, but 8% sounds like a small number to me, having lived through that. For a while, in the early days of the Reagan administration, in an effort to tame that inflation, interest rates were 18%. Never take a loan out at 18%. Just do the math on how much you have to pay back on that. Don't do it. Rates will go down. Anyway, so I think that was part of the reason for the name, but of course this is a physical effect. Happening in the very early universe, like so many things in cosmology, I was initially very enthusiastic about this. A lot of people have become somewhat skeptical. But so we trace the history back to the very early universe, and at the time when this was popular, people were working hard on grand unified theories, and this grew out of one of the ideas for how that might work. Grand unified theory being how do you wrestle up all the forces into one theory, not just electromagnetism and weak theory, but those together and have the electroweak theory, also wrapping in the strong nuclear force, and ultimately, hopefully, gravity as all part of one theory of everything. That now just look different because of symmetry breakings that happened as the universe cooled off. So we're talking about this super early time, 10 to the minus 35 seconds, give or take an order of magnitude, when densities were incredibly high and particle interactions were basically way in the nuclear regime, particle. And so here's the scale size as a function of time, which you've seen a lot now. In the early universe, of course, this is constant. The temperature times the time, temperature squared times the time is a constant, as we've derived. And so it's just this straight line going back in time. And then inflation imagines that there's an early period of exponential growth. So rather than just extrapolating this all the way back to zero, at some very early time, you had an exponential expansion. So things that were very tiny were equated to be somewhat less tiny, well, a lot less tiny, but still very tiny. Even early universe is still very dense. But you know, there was a lot of growth in a very short time. Now, this was one of these theories where there were a confluence of concerns that it seemed to address simultaneously. And this gave it a sort of intellectual momentum that it felt like it had to be right because it did all these things for us. So what did it do? It solved the flatness problem, the horizon problem, the magnetic monopole problem. And it also provides the seeds for the formation of large-scale structure. So here's the theoretical idea where you go back with the electromagnetic force and weak to high enough energies, they become indistinguishable, and that lets you write down the electroweak theory. And so they are unified in some sense at energies higher than that. You hope to wrap in the strong force, you can write a theory for that, quantum chromodynamics. but the unification scale is at much higher energy, so much earlier time, right? So here's the energy scale, the corresponding temperature in Kelvin, and when it happens in the early universe. So even for the electroweak thing, we're talking at 10 to the minus 12 seconds, that's super early on. For the gut scale, we're talking 10 to the minus 35, give or take, seconds. And 10 to the 12 TeV, the LHC is about up to 70 TeV. So we're talking, you know, 27 orders of, no, 12, this unit, 12. So 11 or 12 orders of magnitude more than we can hope to do in the best particle accelerators that we've built so far. And so this is the sort of thing that led a lot of particle physicists to start becoming interested in cosmology and seeing the universe as the big particle accelerator in the sky. And, you know, you do, as we heard, sometimes still get, well, those of you who are journal club heard, we do still sometimes get crazy high things like gamma ray bursts that produce 10 to the 28 TeV photons or whatever the hell it was. It's just crazy amount of energy to invest in a single photon. So it's all really cool, right? Wrap all these things together. So let's think about how these things actually happen and, in fact, what these things mean and how inflation addresses them. So what is the idea of inflation? Well, so this emerged from what was called the bag model of very dense nuclear matter that Alan Guth was working on around 1980. And he showed that he was working on grand unified theories, not cosmology. And you're trying to understand what the heck would happen to nuclear matter at these super dense things. And he worked out that in this particular model, it was a specific theory, there was an effective equation of state where the pressure went like the negative of the density. Well, you may recognize that from how we talk about the cosmological constant in space. Okay. So Guth realized that this would have the same effect. Of course, the early universe was very dense, and so it's the only place where this might actually apply. So you had an effective what we would nowadays call cosmological constant. Back then, cosmological constant was verbose. We didn't talk about Einstein's idea, but the vacuum itself had some energy density, which we can now associate with this effective inflationary cosmological constant. That's not the same as the one we have today. It's a scale to do with the energy density that's associated with the vacuum, and in particular the quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. So this is some artistic rendering of what's going on at a very microscopic scale in the vacuum itself. Everything's coming and going, and of course on average things go as often as they come, and so the average is zero. But the RMS is non-zero, and so you can write down an energy density associated with that.
It's representing the quantum fluctuations, but it's also representing the dense nuclear matter. So, are they the same thing, or how are they related?
Well, so that's a good question, because basically this is just the space. This is the false vacuum, so you don't need the nuclear matter there.
Oh, he was just investigating nuclear matter and thought they could relate.
Exactly. And so one imagined that the universe had this transition, that there was some effective potential, which is nowadays usually called the inflaton, but there's some potential associated with space itself, that vacuum energy density, and that the early state was this false vacuum that then transitioned, you know, maybe some quantum tunneling through this barrier to a true vacuum that we have today, where this is exactly zero. That was what was imagined at the time. Of course, it's not quite zero. Right? We have a little bit of cosmological constant now. But this was what was imagined at the time initially. You were having this tunneling, and this corresponded, you see this particular fluctuation is sort of showing it's a bubble, like it's about to disconnect, and that was the idea for the literal creation of the universe. You had this bubble separate up out of this vast background foam and then start inflating away, so that is our universe. You can imagine other universes, and we get into multi-universes, right? But our universe in this picture is just a free lunch that happens to boil up out of the quantum background. This is a pretty cool and thereby compelling idea, and that blue blobby thing was a more modern version of what I cannot find anymore, but was all over the literature in the 80s, and in fact, literally all over Guth's office were scribbles like this. I took a class from Scott Tremaine in my senior year. I had been away observing the week of the final, so when I got back, he put me in the office next door to take the final, and that happened to be Alan Guth's office. And there were little scraps of paper with this, literally hundreds of them, all over the office. He just doodled this like that was his job. That's what he did. We're really, a little bit of obsessiveness is good, because it makes us think about these things, but it also allows us to be trapped in the beauty of our own ideas, so you have to be careful about that. Yeah.
Can you go back one slide?
Never.
Or I guess one more. So, I don't know, I guess I just don't understand what the false vacuum means. Is that like what exists outside of the universe is?
So it's a Heisenberg thing, Heisenberg uncertainty. So there's a vacuum, it has nothing, right? Definition of a vacuum. But at some microscopic level, there is Heisenberg uncertainty. Right, at that level. And so you can have a virtual pair of particles particle and antiparticle pair pop into existence, right? Worldwide, they're real particles, and as long as, and so, you know, that energy tells you how massive they get to be, mc squared, and this tells you how long they live, and as long as they go away again within that time, then it's a free lunch again, basically, at that. Weird things about quantum mechanics is the vacuum isn't empty because you can always spontaneously create particle antiparticle pairs, and they're always coming and going within this Heisenberg limit. And that's sort of what this nonsense is supposed to represent, that frothing energy production and then disappearance within the Heisenberg uncertainty. So, like I say, this comes and goes, so on average it's nothing, but the RMS of that is not nothing, and that's what that energy density represents. You can also think of it as a pressure of the vacuum, right? That because there's this going on, you end up with that equation of state. And this is practically observed in any other situations because so, for example, we know the Higgs particle now exists. For a long time, that was just a Higgs field that mediated certain interactions between particles. And they did so through a whole series of these virtual particles. And so, you know, when you talk about, okay, a photon bounces off, scatters off something, well, how does it actually do that? And one invokes a whole chain of exchanges of virtual particles, these things that come and go. And that sounds all like just a philosophical excuse for how to think about it. Maybe it is, but you need it to calculate it to get those things right. So there are cases, you know, the reason the predictions for the Higgs came true is because you use that concept of predictions. So it's reasonable to think of that going on. Now, of course, what we're doing now in cosmology is imagining there's a lot more going on. going on, i.e. the energy density was higher in this original false vacuum. And what gave birth to our modern universe is tunneling through it to the true vacuum, which you would have thought would go to zero, but it doesn't. Right? A little bit of cosmological constant left, or energy density, dark energy density, whatever the heck you want to call it. Yeah.
I've read a really nice analogy for that. Do you mind if I share?
Sure.
So it's basically like the particle pair is like coming out of nothing. So the analogy is like stealing money from a bank, or like borrowing money from a bank. So like the higher the energy, or the higher the mass, like in that equation, is like the more money you steal. So if you steal a lot of money, like someone's gonna notice pretty quickly. So you have to give it back a lot faster. So like the more massive the particle, the quicker it will like not exist anymore. But like if you just borrow a little bit of money, it might be a long time
before
somebody notices. So that's the analogy.
Yeah, so, you know, if there's credit card fraud, you know, you make some purchase online, it's a few $100. Credit card company don't care. They literally do not care. It is too expensive to prosecute, even if they can identify the perpetrator. I knew that because my wife had her purse stolen once. They didn't charge us for it, but they didn't bother pursuing the culprit either, because it was too small in exactly the way you described. And I see what you mean about the high mass end. I'm not sure that if you borrow a huge amount of money and fail to repay it right away, that works. You would think it would, but maybe that just makes you Elon Musk or Donald Trump or something. People loan you money when they know they really shouldn't. Anyway. That is how the budget works. And so we know this part of it really well, and theoretically we know this part of it quite well, the standard model of particle physics. But we don't know what comes beyond that, and that's where ideas of supersymmetry came up. And that gives you a hypothetical set of dark sector things, including potential dark matter candidates. We don't know that part experimentally. And we certainly don't know what the theory of everything is, quantum gravity. It's kind of a big issue. But anyway, one of the first things that the inflationary theory was invoked to solve is the magnetic monopole problem. The idea was that in these grand unified theories, magnetic force, same as the electric force, it should have a charge. It's not just that magnetism happens as a response to flowing current, but you'd actually have single charged monopoles, magnetic monopoles, so magnetic charge. If these things existed and were common, they'd be super easy to detect, and people had made it just like free charges would be easy to detect, right? People made experiments looking for them and pretty quickly put strong limits on how common they could be. And one way to avoid them being too common is to make them super massive so that they only appear at these ridiculously high energy scales. So the idea was that, yeah, those things exist, but they're really big massive things, so they're only in thermal equilibrium super early in the universe when the energy scales are super high. Grand unified scale. So they were there. They exist in their equilibrium state at the time, and then inflation happened and spread them way, 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 way out, so you never run into them. Right? So they're just super rare because they were so massive. They froze out before inflation, and inflation spread them literally all across creation. Maybe they don't exist, but, you know, that was the idea. And that was a problem taken seriously at the time. That was a big motivation. The thing that really sold it, though, was the flatness problem, which I would describe more properly as a coincidence problem. And you can find this argument on Ed Wright's cosmology tutorial, or in any cosmology textbook written in the 80s. Thereafter. But The coincidence is, why is the mass density that we observe anywhere near to 1? Why couldn't it be 100 or 42? Already a nerd reference there, right? This was about the same time as the original radio broadcast of Hitchhiker's Guide. Or why not 0.002 or some really tiny number, which is actually pretty close to the density of stars and nothing else? And that's a good question. Why is that? As you've already shown in your homework, the mass density, and back then, remember, we didn't have lambda. So you see omega, it just meant omega matter. So omega naught is omega matter naught, the mass density right now. And as a function of time, it behaves like that. Now, strictly speaking, that's for a matter-dominated universe. And you have other cases, as you saw. But that means that omega, as you look back in time, is closer and closer to 1. So here are a couple of those examples. This blue line, so this is redshift, so 0 is here, it's logarithmic redshift, so this is really high, redshift 10,000 up here. Omega now, way back in at 10,000, redshift 10,000, which is 1.0001, and now it's 100. So it took that case. Or it could start out at 0.9. And now it's basically 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so why is it that we live at a time when omega is anywhere close to 1? Remember, there were constraints that we discussed last time, like from Davis, ergocentric infall, omega is about 0.4. So it's within a factor of 2 of 1, and it should not be. Right, it's a huge coincidence that we live at a time when omega matter is anywhere close to 1, because it's going to spend eternity doing something different. Here's another example of that. This is what omega matter now would be based on what it starts out at, z of 1,000 anyway, and you know, just the orders of magnitude away. So that was called the flatness problem, that we're close to flat. How could it be that we're close to a flat universe? And in those days, flat meant omega matter equals 1, not omega matter plus omega lambda. So we didn't talk about lambda. And here's the same argument put a slightly different way. So here's a scale factor as a function of time, all the way up until now. And you know, here's the critical density universe. So that's what we wanted to live in, that omega matter equals 1 was the only natural solution because of this problem. And so I think it was Cope and Turner that phrased it this way, that, well, imagine what the density is just 1 nanosecond after the Big Bang. In a flat critical density universe, it would be this number. If it were just 0.8 grams above that, you would have a universe that had collapsed by now, be right back at the Big Crunch. And that's why that they picked that 0.8 difference. That's what it would take to have a universe that was recollapsing now. Or if it were a bit less dense, then it would just be expanding away as an open universe. And we would be, again, nowhere close to omega matter equals 1. So how can it be? How can it be so, as the Grinch might say? Okay, now you've done this problem, you know what the solution is. What's special about 1 nanosecond? Nothing. There's absolutely no reason they could have done this calculation at 1 second, or a microsecond, or 100 years, and you'd still make the same argument, but the equations force everything to go back to that critical density. And so it's not really a well-posed problem. We spent a lot of time obsessing about this. And this solution to the coincidence problem is what solved inflation. That was the thing it solved that really convinced most of us it had to be true. Because it was the difference between just sitting on this line, so this is now
omega matter as a function of time or redshift, so that I've got, if you see these little tiny, I've extrapolated into the future this way. Right? So we are now, and if you're at omega matter equals exactly one, then you stay there forever, and it's not surprising that you're at that value. But you choose any other value, and if it's less than one, then it gets less and less and less than one and spends all of eternity at zero. So how is it that we happen to live here within a factor of a few of that, when all of the future, these are logarithmic, mind you, is going to be spent at zero?
That's why I say it's more properly a coincidence problem. It's not about the geometry. Nothing to do whether it's flat or not. It's the coincidence that we live when omega matter is anywhere close to one. That's a problem. And so the geometry, and GR, I could be anything Robertson Walker allows. That's fine. But so the way inflation solved this problem is that, you know, you can write, as we have, the curvature is 1 minus the sum of all the other omegas that you might have, baryons, dark matter, axions, whatever's out there. And so you can ask how that evolves. Okay, well, it just, you know, the curvature goes down as the universe expands at a rate that depends on the Hubble parameter. Well, if you have a period of inflation, then, as you know, the expansion is exponential. And again, this is the Hubble parameter during the time of inflation. It is actually a constant. It's not changing in numerical value during that time. And the solution is exponential. So think about what that does to the geometry. You could have any arbitrary initial geometry you wanted, but then you go through this exponential expansion, and that just looks flat after enough e-folding times have gone by, because this is in the denominator, and so you have a lot of e-folding times, and the curvature just gets flattened out. Just completely smoothed out, ironed out. And it's just any curve looks flat if you zoom in on it enough, right? Any curve. This is a bugaboo of mine, because in rotation curve fitting for galaxies that exhibit the cusp core problem, there's some rotation curve data, and of course a model that fits well goes through the lines. And if you try to fit the halo, the cuspy NFW halo predicted by dark matter simulations, it does that move. Have a dead hand. You know, it really wants to do that, because V is predicted to go as the square root of R, where it really is a more linear thing. But you feed that to a fitting program and say, oh, I can make this look like a straight line if I just stretch it out. And you end up with a halo that looks like this. And I literally mean that. The parameter of the halo for these really low mass galaxies, where this tends to happen, is like, okay, you got a 10 to the 8 solar mass galaxy, it lives in a 10 to the 14 solar mass halo, no problem. Of course, that's a silly number, right? It's like a giant cluster of galaxies. But that's what happens to the parameter to stretch out this square root into something more like a linear thing. You've just zoomed in on it. And in the case of inflation, you are driven inexorably by this period of exponential expansion to a flat geometry, which in the absence of a cosmological constant requires that omega matter be one. So you are driven to the solution that you want, that you live right here. And so it's not a surprise at all that we measure something close to one, because it is one. It has to be one. And the inflationary theorists told us all through the 80s and well into the 90s that we were stupid for measuring anything else. You just had to look harder and you would find it. Okay, another problem is the horizon problem, sometimes called the smoothness problem. That is, if you look at the microwave background, it's both homogeneous and isotropic, right? It looks the same all over the sky. We had not yet detected any fluctuations beyond the dipole in the microwave background at the time. Well, how can that be so? And this is a bit puzzling because you can calculate what the horizon distance is, and now I'm talking about the light horizon, not the sound horizon. But basically that sets the limits of causal contact. How can a particle know about another particle? In order to know, it should be at the same temperature. All right, so this piece of the sky way over here is at exactly the same temperature as that sky over there, as that patch over there, that's over there. But if you look at the world lines going back in time, we see now, so here we are living now, this blue line represents the moment of recombination, and that's the beginning of time up there. And so this little yellow patch represents the particles that are in causal contact at the time of recombination. But the horizon keeps growing, at least as long as A of t goes to a power of n less than 1. For n less than 1, then the horizon is growing faster than the universe is expanding. That is, we get to see more and more and more of it as time goes on. But that raises the puzzle right now. Okay, our horizon is much bigger now than it was for particles back then. But how do these guys know to be exactly the same temperature as those guys? Because they were not yet in causal contact. Okay, so that's the horizon problem. Or as I say, equivalently, the smoothness problem. How is it that the microwave background is as smooth as it is? And that was known at the time, to some reasonable limit. So without inflation, then you know, you are now viewing things. So this is, all these little circles are the horizon in the past, and everything expands, but the horizon grows faster than that co-moving size was. So now they're in contact, but they weren't back then. How'd they know it'd all be the same temperature? Well, in inflation, the expansion outstrips that horizon growth. So you had a time early on when all these things were in causal contact, and then you rip them apart by this exponential inflation. So they were in causal contact back in the day, to the minus 3.5 seconds. And they just got yanked apart. And only now that the expansion is going more as like t to the 1 or t to the 2/3 or something, is the horizon catching back up with that. And so things are falling back into the horizon that used to be in causal contact. Now the thing that bugs me about this is, as we've derived this product, the square of the temperature times the time during radiation domination, is just a constant, and that constant is nothing but fundamental number, speed of light, radiation constant. So you could just say, well, they're the same temperature because they have to be. That's what that equation says. They really have no choice. And so people can get into towering arguments over the initial conditions. You can get out of this problem by saying, well, they started out at the same temperature, and that's why they are observed to be the same temperature. And then you have imposed on the thing an assumption that the initial conditions were the same. Yeah, but there's a pretty good physical reason for that imposition. Just saying that the physics is the same.
So are you saying that you don't think it's a problem?
Yeah, I'm saying I don't think it was ever a problem.
So you said that it makes sense that they would all have the same temperature because it's the same physics. isn't the reason that we believe that there would be variations in temperature just because of like quantum fluctuations?
Well, that, so we don't know about those yet, but we predict them, right? So there are quantum fluctuations and that those get exponentially expanded. And in the context of inflation, that is the reasons for the density fluctuations that we do observe. So right now we're just talking about moment zero, that everything's the same temperature. So what you're saying is true, but that applies to the quadrupole at higher moments, those little fluctuations. And in fact, that is a compelling thing of inflation, that it not only explains why everything is the same temperature, but where those fluctuations come from that then grow into galaxies. Took quantum fluctuations and you blew them up to the size of the whole universe.
So you're saying you don't think we have a reason to believe there were fluctuations that could have blown up?
No, I'm saying that's perfectly reasonable. I'm just saying we don't really need inflation to solve the horizon problem. That the temperature's the same everywhere just because physics says so. That's an arrow of time argument, essentially, that entropy can only increase. So if you look back in time, it's just like omega going back to 1. It has to be less than it has to.
So the other people are saying, or like the inflation people are saying that if there were these quantum fluctuations and plus inflation, that would explain what we see now. I'm just having
sure.
a hard time understanding why everything would be constant. Like, do you not just in general expect there to be some kind of statistical fluctuations on the temperature in the beginning?
Yes, but you're getting ahead of the story. So there are two separate problems there. One is just, why is the temperature so uniform over the sky when these different patches on the sky were not in causal contact at that time? And the other thing is what the fluctuations on top of that are in fact doing. So let's put that on discussion on the floor. Right now I'm just saying what they're saying is true, that those things were not in causal contact. The way out of that, if you don't want to have inflation, is to say it had to be true in the initial conditions. I'm pointing this equation to say it's pretty reasonable to think. But I don't like imposing solutions from just, oh, it had to be that way to start. Physics said it had to be that way to start.
So do other people share this view?
Some. Yeah, I don't know how widespread it is. There's a whole field of inflationary cosmology, and certainly within that field, they'd be giving me out on to for me to state by now. It's a self-selection, right? So people who think, as I've just described, and I used to think this was a compelling argument, and I don't anymore, so maybe I'll change my mind again. But the people who don't think it's a compelling argument don't work on inflationary cosmology. So ask somebody who's thought about it, but who isn't actually an inflationary cosmologist.
Yeah, I was just kind of like wondering, why is assuming that the universe had the same initial conditions everywhere like any better from kind of like a not fudging the numbers type of deal?
So I like this one because, like I say, they're just fundamental constants. There's no fudging there. That does implicitly assume that the universe we live in had the same physics everywhere. So that is an assumption about the initial conditions. God wrote down that Newton's constant would be exactly this, and the speed of light would be exactly that. And why should that be true? And why should that be true in different patches? And that's why people talk about multiverses. Like, well, maybe it's not always true, and some of these numbers do seem kind of fine-tuned and coincident in an unnatural way. But the only thing you can do to get beyond that is indeed to envision multiverses in which there's completely different physics and we're just one realization out of some spectrum of possible physical constants or whatever physics is. And that's really cool, and that's more religion than physics, because you can never test it in the lab. Join.
I keep getting like lost in my own thoughts, like trying to think about this. So when people refer to like the Big Bang, they're referring to this like, well, like the creation of the universe, but this moment of inflation where it expanded really fast and now it's still expanding, but when people refer to inflation or the Big Bang, they're referring to this
Well, no, the Big Bang is just this running back to zero.
Okay.
And whether it also had this inflationary period, there it was all the way at the beginning. Right, so that you started out early, hot, and the universe is expanding, that's the hot Big Bang. And so that's all part of the hot Big Bang. And what we're arguing about now is if in a super early period of the Big Bang, there was this period of exponential growth. But they're both Big Bang.
Okay.
It's just this is a bigger bang, I guess. So, you know, growth sense.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So what are the other options? So, like...
Oh, gee. I mean, steady state universe is the most commonly discussed one. People have stopped discussing that. They pretty much have abandoned it, and its advocates have largely died out. There are things you can do to make that consistent with observations, but it's tough. You have to violate mass conservation. You basically have to create matter. So that the idea is that things always look the same, and so as the universe expands, that's fine. You just have to create new galaxies so it always looks like it's the same density. Yet if you look back at high enough redshift, there are a lot of quasars then that aren't around now. It doesn't really hang together. But that's the most common alternative that I think of all day.
So I guess the way you were talking, I was thinking that you disagreed with this, but do you think that there was an inflationary period?
I'm open-minded about that. There are some nice things that it does. I sound skeptical because it doesn't really do some of the things it's sold to.
So you think there's something else that maybe people aren't talking about?
Well, I think we don't know. I think we've glommed on to this for reasons that in retrospect are somewhat suspect. At the time, they made great sense. But once we get an idea like that embedded in our worldview, it's very hard to step back and say, well, is that really right? We've already accepted that it's right, by and large. And so how do we ever persuade ourselves it's not? Should it not be? We actually need something to test it. And inflation has gotten a reputation as being a theory that you can cook up a flavor of inflation that fits just about anything. And that's unhealthy, theoretically.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to get a sense of just like the lay of the land regarding inflation. So I guess my impression was like I learned about it and I was like, this is cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then all my experiences since then were kind of just like, oh, it seems like this is kind of standard.
It is very standard, yeah.
So I guess my question is, I guess most people aren't skeptical of it, but do most people like hardcore believe in that, or they just
most
kind of let it go?
Most people who work on cosmology are not skeptical of it, right? Like I say, there is a self-selection there. So if you want to work on cosmology, then there are two things you can do, both of which you said. You hardcore believe in it if you're actually working on inflation cosmology, or you just accept it as something that's there that may or may not impact the rest of your work. So if you work on galaxies and you believe that those grew from the temperature fluctuation, the density fluctuations associated with the temperature on the microwave background, and the inflationary guys tell you, okay, those fluctuations came from the inflationary growth of quantum fluctuations, you're like, cool, but it doesn't really matter to what you're doing. So you kind of low-key accepted it that well. And so I accept that galaxies probably grew from those density fluctuations, and it's sort of neither here nor me there to me if it was caused by inflation or not. Inflation does give you a compelling reason for that, because the quantum fluctuations give you this Gaussian random field that then get expanded to that. It's a Gaussian random field. Anything will do that, right? So inflation gives you a really cool explanation, but it's not the only unique, must be that explanation. There were papers before inflation, like people who wanted to calculate the power spectrum and they didn't know what to do, so they basically said, well, let's just assume it's Gaussian random, because what else would it be? You get basically the same predictions out of that. So yes, you would like to know where those things come from, the density. Inflation is the best explanation I've heard of.
But like I say, it's not unique. It's not, has to be that, which a lot of people sometimes seem to take that extra step. I don't know how many you know it is.
Well, that. This is getting way ahead of the story, but we probably won't even get there. So there are predictions of some inflationary theories for like the polarization and the BB polarization. The CMB has not yet been detected. It's due to tensor terms, basically very large scale gravitational waves. That would be a convincing detection of something like that. People were so eager to believe it that there was an experiment 7 years ago, BICEP, that claimed such a detection. And it was wrong. It was just wrong. It's really dangerous to, whenever you're looking for something and you think it's a Nobel Prize winning thing and you find it, that signal you want, it's very easy to blind yourself to maybe it's not really there, right? It's tough. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, because I'd like to look into it, not that I'm trying to like undermine you. What are like some alternatives to inflation? I mean, you said that inflation is the most convincing we've heard, but I'm just curious.
I don't care. Like I say, I literally don't care. Paul Steinhardt was one of the early advocates of inflation. He's become one of its big critics, and I've heard him talk about ideas for other things. I didn't find them any more convincing, so I haven't really paid attention. But that would be a name to look up, since, yeah, because it is a very active field. People who worry about that. And it's so active that within the bubble of the people who work on that field, if you say cosmology, they think that's all it means. Right? That's why I sort of made the comment early in the course that you know, you could work on that first 10 to the minus 35 seconds, or you could work on the 13 billion years that comes after. Right? It's not just that. It's an important subfield. They don't know it. They're in their own inflationary bubble. That's really the way they talk. So one of the reasons that I became skeptical is exactly this argument. This was the argument that convinced me we had to have inflation. And most people, this was the most important thing. So the horizon problem was an issue. The monopole problem was, I guess, if you really believed in monopoles. But this was the thing that convinced most of us inflation was right. Is that this only happens for a brief period of time when you're around a third and not there. So if it's really, really a third of make a matter then and not one, then it's not inflation, is it? And by the mid-90s, we knew it was not, we were not going to get to a mega matter one. That was not going to happen. So okay, it was close, it was a good idea, but it was wrong, because that was the prediction of inflation. So mega matter was 1.0000. We've replaced it with lambda CDM, and you've done this calculation too, I've just done it in this thing, where omega matter is 1.1111000, and it trades out, it swaps with omega lambda, shown in this way. So coincidence problem that motivated the entire thing is now worse than it was to begin with. Right? So what bugs me about inflation and why I'm really skeptical of it is exactly this. We were convinced to accept inflation because this was close to that. And this was bad. But now, to save inflation, we have a flat geometry, and this is what the inflationary theorists will tell you. Well, it predicted that the curvature goes to zero and the geometry gets flat, so it's fine to have omega matter and omega lambda, and that is true. The geometry is flat, but that is the weak sauce version of the prediction. The real prediction was that omega matter was one for all perpetuity. That was what they really predicted. And if we allow the more general case, oh yeah, it could be omega matter plus omega lambda, that's true, it gives you a flat geometry. But it doesn't do squat to solve the coincidence problem, which is what we were really upset about and what we really bought it for in the first place. And in fact, it makes the coincidence problem worse because this swap between mass domination and lambda domination happened in cosmics yesterday.
and this is why you hear people talk about the Anthropic principle and things. It's like, this is really probabilistically unlikely, so how do we explain that? Anthropic principle. We could only be alive in this time. Well, that's true. There's no structure left at this time because the universe starts inflating again. Remember, lambda drives inflation, just like inflation. So the horizon starts to shrink again, so way far in the future, there's nothing left inside of your horizon. So yeah, you're not going to make new life forms then. But it's still a pretty dodgy argument to have to invoke. I mean, it would have been natural if omega matter were one. That would have been great. It's not what happened. So I guess I am disappointed by theories that predict something and then do the bait and switch on you. It's essentially what this was. Oh, did we say omega matter is one? We just made omega matter plus omega lambda. And yeah, we sold you on this, and now we're just going to ignore it. And they are guilty of that. You will not hear very many inflationary theorists worrying about this coincidence problem. Not all of them. Rocky Cole is one who said, yeah, this is really a problem. And anyway, that is why I personally became disaffected and disillusioned with this particular thing. So it no longer explains what it so brilliantly explained. This was the big one, was what was called in the flatness problem. It's really the coincidence problem, and it's not really solved. It's not. Making the universe flat is not a big deal. It didn't have to be flat. It had to avoid this coincidence. Then there's a horizon problem, which I go back and forth on, but again, this physics just as well. Why is this really a problem? And then the magnetic monopole problem was just a figment of a grand unified theory, none of which have worked out in any way. So maybe they just aren't there. There is a small problem that came up early, and then, which was that the graceful exit problem. In order to drive you down to a universe that is as low curvature as we observe, you need a bunch of E foldings, 50 or 60. Well, why, once you start inflating, why do you ever stop? Right? You have that E to the HT expansion. There's no reason for that to stop in old inflation, 1981 inflation. 1982 inflation, who was it? Albrecht and Steinhardt introduced slow roll inflation. There is the potential. Looks nice and simple, doesn't it? And so here's their potential as a function of the inflaton. And you can see you can get these different shapes, some of which are kind of flat. And so this was called slow roll inflation, because you didn't just have this tunneling or a barrier that couldn't be penetrated at all, but more or less of a plateau that you sort of very gradually moved along and then fell out of. So this is said to have fix the graceful exit problem. You do inflate for a while, but then you do stop inflating at some point. So nowadays, inflationary theorists spend a lot of time worrying about exactly what this potential is and coming up with different theories to do that. That's an entire field. As you hear, I'm a little skeptical of it, so I don't pay much more attention. But it's cool stuff. It's just mostly theoretical. I do want to give you some more perspective on where we came from with this problem. So this is from an article by David Tram back in 1993. This is in this book, which as near as I can tell was a conference in 92 or 91, where they got together a bunch of philosophers and scientists and historians of science and talked about cosmology. Tram was one of the big proponents of inflation early on, and also he did a lot of work on Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So remember I said this was already a well-established thing by the early 90s, and here is a very familiar looking figure, isn't it? Right. So that figure has not changed for 30 some years.
the number has changed a little. It's a little closer to 0.1, but, you know, calculations have changed a little bit. But you recognize all this, right? It's the same now as it was then, but for a few details. Here is another picture of, I'm just showing you the figures that he laid out here. This is the mass density of the scale. So omega, he means omega matter. That was the only omega that we talked about back then. As a function of scale, and you can see it's just depicted as a linear rise. Right? We talked about this last time, whereas that's not what I saw. But a lot of people use this to say that, yeah, we'll get up to omega equals 1 if we just look on big enough scales. That didn't happen. You never really got beyond about 0.3 around the cluster scale. And this has plenty of big error bars, so it's not even wrong. It's just misleading to show it this way. Though notice here, this is the baryon density, bigger uncertainties back then, but this range is 0.1. We had the missing baryon problem. What you could actually see was less than what you thought there should be from the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And if you added up the dark matter halos that you needed for all the galaxies that you knew about at the time, then it didn't get out of this range. So you could imagine halos made of machos, brown dwarfs, something purely baryonic. And it was only when you got to larger scales that omega matter started to be clearly bigger than omega baryon. Of course, it helps here that the scale is logarithmic. Here's the growth of structure. Right, that looks familiar too, right? This is the amplitude of a density fluctuation. It gets up to the nonlinear scale here. It starts out very small. At the time, this was just a limit. We hadn't yet measured them. They came in down here is where they came, but all we knew was there was a limit, but that we needed the dark matter to grow to get up to here. And the baryons had to follow after. Right? And then there was some babbling about a phase transition that I never hear mentioned again, so I guess that went out of favor. He made a mass budget. There's what we can, well, what we expect in baryons. That number has grown a bit, but still basically the same. And it's grown because he assumed H0 was 50, because that's what all the inflationary theorists assumed, because they wanted omega matter to be 1. We don't see it all, but then there can be all sorts of normal dark things, Jupiter's brown dwarfs, intergalactic gas, black holes, that sort of thing. And then all the rest is non-baryonic, and note that's what we would now call cold dark matter. He allowed, maybe it was just heavy neutrinos back then, that's excluded now. But notice that that omega matter is 0.94 in cold dark matter. There was no lambda, so it was a lot of dark matter. Yeah.
Is Jupiter just referring to like really large exoplanets that we don't see?
Sorry, which one?
Jupiter's.
Jupiter's, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
That's right. Jupiter mass things scattered around wherever. And those are things, both those in brown dwarfs and stellar scale black holes, they're all constrained now by the microlensing experiments, which hadn't yet happened at this time. They were just trying to control. But at the time, it was perfectly reasonable to have this whole perfectly reasonable. It was hard to arrange, but you could at least imagine that the entire halo of a Milky Way like the galaxy. A Milky Way like galaxy had baryons in its halo and nothing else, just brown dwarfs. How you would have other dark matter and not have it stick to that, well, that's a lot harder. So I wouldn't say it's reasonable, but you could imagine it. Yeah.
So why are stellar black holes under baryonic matter?
Because
planetary mass black holes are under non-baryonic.
Because of the way you make them, I'd have to go back and see why he would want to do this. But stellar mass black holes are a fairly natural product of stellar evolution. Right? You make a big enough star, it blows up and leaves behind the black hole. To make a planetary mass black hole, well, stars won't do that. They make bigger things. So you have to have some other mechanism. So each of these things have their own distinct production mechanism, and I don't know why he favored planetary mass black holes. That's one flavor of primordial black hole theory. The trick there is producing them early on. How do you make them?
And that's pretty much excluded now, again, by the microgrids. All right, so then there's large-scale structure, which, if you listen to cosmologists today, is the great success story that can only be explained by lambda CDM. And it's that only that always bugs me in. Is well explained by lambda CDM. It's not obvious, it's unique. And we got it really wrong before we got it right, and we have consistently gotten it wrong. So this is the number as a function of redshift, and which redshift survey was it? The Broadhurst survey at the time. And so you see all these spikes. These are the walls and things and the redshift distribution. There's a lot of structure there, right? If you just had a homogeneous universe, then you would get that broad curve. So that universe is very non-homogeneous on this scale, and that is a lot more structure than we expected on those scales. And we were surprised by that. Same thing for the correlation function. So this is the correlation function we talked about last time. It's a function of angular scale in the sky. This was the prediction CDM model. Of course, he meant what we now call standard CDM. That was the only model at the time. This was the prediction. This is the observation. And you can see there's a lot more clustering on large scales than was predicted. And it's off by a couple orders of magnitude. It's not a subtle failure. And so if you actually read his text, it's got some really weak sauce things. Like, well, the fluctuations could still be due to inflation. Yeah, that's true, but this is what you actually predicted to do. And that's been reconfirmed many times now. This is that. A different measurement of the correlation function transformed through the power of Fourier transformation into the power spectrum of galaxies. So this is wave number. So basically the scale, small here, big here. Power. This is what, 93? Yeah, also in 1993. So there's a galaxy power spectrum. It's showing the same thing. There is more power on large scales than you can fit with a CDM model, including COBE. So the first detection of fluctuations on beyond the dipole was from the COBE satellite in 91, 92. And after having looked for these fluctuations for so hard, we were like, wait, that's too much. Right? So we were predicting this red line, or actually we were free to shift this line down. And so fitting galaxies like we had before, we actually predicted even less. And here he's trying to, Carlo's trying to balance it out here. But the shape is just wrong, right? And so standard CDM was already ruled out in the early 90s. A while to die. But this was the prediction, because omega matter was 1, H naught was 50, so that combination, which is what basically sets the shape of that line, is 0.5, sigma 8, the RMS fluctuation, that sets the amplitude. You know, it's higher now, it's like 0.85, but that's not a big deal. The real thing is the shape was just wrong. And to get the shape right, you need lower omega matter, basically. Omega matter was not 1, damn it. Another detail that's interesting now, especially, you know, people are worrying about whether galaxies are already big, that redshift 10 in the JWST data. Fram was already worried that, geez, there's quasars at redshift 4. That shouldn't be. So this has been, right, so you know, you can estimate when these things should happen as well as they get big. So my experience with structure formation is that there's always bigger things in place sooner than expected. There's always been more structure than we expected in the universe. And so sure, you can fit this power spectrum, but apparently you can't predict it. That's the key difference. Okay. Any more questions? All right, well, enjoy Thanksgiving. That's enough for today. If you didn't already get your homework, it's up here.
presume nobody minds if I run a little bit.
Yeah, we can just like use our formula sheets. Yeah, I mean, we can just bring it to the other one. Yeah, I wonder if we just brought him back.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, we can just. I have a fake line for the first one. The second one is good. And the entire back from what I want to the second exam is question the second exam. The entire back of that is example problems, those are going to be useless. So I could just replace that with what I want for the first exam.
Sure. Yeah, also, we can just bring two sheets.
Yeah.